This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com. This podcast is brought to you by Ants Memory Profiler 5. It offers clear presentation for profiling results so you can find your memory leak within minutes.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on August 18th of 2009. Tonight's guest is Milan Negavan. He runs the site aspnetresources.com. That's a site that's been around for years. I've been a follower. Many of us have been following his blog. And he's been working with ASP.NET for 9 years. He was an MVP for a while. Right now, he's an independent consultant. He considers himself a UI guy and also a back-end junkie. And one of the topics that Milan came to talk to us about is web standards and why they're important. So what is the deal with web standards?
Well, I guess a little bit of history would help here. Sometime around late, I think 2003, I stumbled upon a couple of blogs of early proponents of web standards, and names like Dan Sederholm and Jeffrey Zillman, Molly Holschlag, and Andy Budd probably ring a bell if you follow this. Alistapar.com has been very helpful. This site is still up, and they publish a lot of really great articles. So I started reading these blogs, and the whole idea of web standards began to click little by little. And really, the big idea is we are, I think it's safe to say that we're all ASP.NET junkies to some extent. And we tend to argue about the front end and the back, well, not so much front end, but perhaps back end and the middle tier and this tier and that tier. But at the end of the day, what gets produced is HTML. That's what we deliver to the clients. And we really need to pay attention to the quality of HTML. Now, with all its power, ASP.NET has, this abstraction that we work with called server controls, which sometimes get in the way, sometimes they help, but sometimes they do get in the way in the big way. So it's this never-ending struggle of getting them to produce, clean enough markup. How we came to all of this is, I guess, there's too much history. You guys probably remember the browser wars of the 90s. A lot of bad practices came out of that, such as, abusing tables, really, for page layout. You probably remember blink tags and marquee and center and all those, the sliding glamorous effects that we're trying to achieve. And there's really a little bit of, unlearning that needs to happen. Also, some of the tools didn't really help much, and they only worsened the whole situation, such as, for example, FrontPage. FrontPage has been notorious for producing some pretty bad markups, but at least that was quick and dirty for most folks. So when we talk about web standards, you will probably hear this notion of semantic markup. And what that really means is you focus on what your content means. So for example, if you want to make something big and bold, you could put a font tag around it to jack up the size and then maybe put a B tag to bold it. Or you could say, well, is this thing big and bold because maybe it's like an article title or a blog post title, so it's the most important thing on the page. And maybe you really should be putting it in an H1 tag, which is the header tag. Or, for example, I guess we used to use the paragraph tags just to create blank lines, but really a P tag designates a paragraph of text. So it takes a little bit, I guess it's a mind shift. Think of not so much a presentation, but content first. And I always think of web standards as really a bunch, like a suite of specifications. I call the web standards trinity, where we have structure, which is usually presented as HTML, XHTML, or XML. Then we have presentation with cascaded style sheets and behavior with JavaScript. So those are sort of like the three pillars. I just want to go briefly over like all three of these, not to take too much of it every time, but XHTML is what we work with mostly these days, and it's really, the definition is kind of funny, it's HTML reformulated with XML syntax. So it's kind of a morphing between HTML and XML, but the browsers are so forgiving that it's more of an idea or more of a goal for us than the browsers, because hypothetically XML should always be well-formed, right? Whereas HTML is notorious for being messy. So we have something in between to work with. And at least when we say that we try to produce XHTML, it's kind of a goal that we're trying to achieve. And the browsers will still be forgiving, but that's really not an excuse anymore. So any XHTML document should really contain a doc type. And when you create a new, for example, ASP.NET page, that's the first line that you see on the page. And doc type is pretty important in the sense that it tells the browser what it is that we're trying to achieve. And there are a couple of modes that a doc type triggers a browser. So, for example, there's the quirks mode, which is what the old browsers used to render markup as. And then there's the strict mode, which really is strict in the sense that it's an obligation on our part to keep content clean to a certain extent. Like non-empty elements should require end tags, like the paragraphs. Like empty elements, like BRs, you know, the breakpoint, should be closed properly. And like all the images should have alt text. And by the way, it's not alt tag. Everybody says alt tag, it's alt text. So those are some very simple rules. And in XHTML, for example, a whole bunch of elements are deprecated, such as, you know, base font and center and other stuff. And the way really to double check your progress is to go into like an HTML validator, run your page through it, and it'll tell you what's wrong.
Okay, so I know that recently there was some news about XHTML specifications. I believe XHTML 2 was kind of shot down in favor of HTML 5. Can you talk about how that affects things, or do you know?
Honestly, I haven't followed HTML 5 yet. But I haven't followed it very closely.
Okay,
I kind of think it's still up somewhere out there on the horizon.
Well, I guess my question was that, you know, with that in mind, I've seen some people say, you know, I don't care about XHTML anymore. I'm going back on just, you know, I'm not going to close my BR tags. I don't care, you know, that kind of thing. And to me, I'd rather, like you're saying, I'd rather see, you know, a document that expresses intent. And I think that's best if you always close your tags and that kind of thing. But I don't know. What's your thoughts on that? Like, what's the point? Why do I need to do XHTML?
Well, this idea of web standards comes with a couple of benefits. And I never say that this is the only way to build web applications. This is not the true way, or the only true way, I guess. It is a way to build web apps, and I think it comes with some very significant benefits. For example, well, if we talk, let's talk about a little bit about CSS, and then that will give a better idea of how, you know, web standards really help you build something cleaner, lighter, and all that. Should we do that?
Actually, I had a comment surrounding the XHTML, and but one of the main advantages or reasons for using XHTML is the fact that you can extend it, so you can namespace in new attributes, elements, etc. In theory.
Actually, I've done that in practice. You're right. You can create your own doc type. You can declare your own elements, perhaps. And if you really need to tweak it a little bit, you can do that. There's
right.
Nothing wrong with that.
So one of the reasons that they're kind of pre-deprecating XHTML2, I guess, not even bothering with it right now, is that HTML5 is going to have some of this, I believe, extensibility built into it. And it has some other new attributes, like the... are they calling it the data attribute now? That kind of does away with a lot of the need for extending your elements in the page. And that kind of goes back to the semantic web model, in that, you know, you want to not only say what you're saying, but also define your vocabulary for your pages, which, you know, started with RDF and hasn't really panned out yet.
Yep. Well, for example, CSS was not a standard, but more of a recommendation for a long time. And that was frustrating a lot of people, because W3C is sort of this big bureaucracy which moves kind of slowly on things. So that was definitely frustrating. So we call it standards, but oftentimes they're really quote-unquote recommendations by W3C. And like Microsoft was notorious years for not following any of that. So like I said, it's more of a standard, I guess, for us. And if we can put enough pressure on vendors, then they start implementing according to the standards, and then they become standards in the true sense of the word. So we'll see how HTML5 pans out, because, you know, it takes years and years and the buy-in of a lot of different companies and a lot of people. I don't know if that answers your question, does it?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. So my opinion is kind of that CSS is just horribly broken and needs to be redone from the ground up. It's based on old print layout methodologies and workflows that just don't apply to the web.
To an extent, yes, that's true, to some extent.
And float is evil.
Float. Well, once you start floating one thing, you float a lot of things around it to contain the float.
I love the float.
So it's a cycle. Well, let's talk about CSS really briefly, because that's the second component in the trinity. And really the idea here is that cascaded style sheets allow to separate content and presentation. So you have your content that you lay out with semantic markup. You give meaning to your content. And then CSS helps you define the layout. You do it for various media. You can define typography and you can define colors. And by media, I mean, you can really declare, for example, you can have a page and you can say, here's a style sheet for screen, for a browser, I mean, for a handheld, maybe projector. And there's a handy one for print. So for example, on my website, every single page is printable because you can declare a style sheet and then take out like navigation, the footer and the shadows, because nobody cares about shadows on the printed page. So when you do a print preview, that style sheet kicks in and then takes out everything. So that's very handy. Now, to come back to the benefits, I think when you do this kind of separation, the code is easy to design and redesign. The idea of strict separation of content presentation is a little elusive. It usually is a mix of both, but that's not an excuse not to try. Also, if we develop server controls, I prefer to simply focus on what they render, and then I worry about the presentation with an external style sheet, which is my beef with a lot of server controls, in that we try to set all these attributes to make them look, you know, this way or that way, where we should really focus on just what they produce and then style them separate. And really, for the record, I want to say that perhaps the worst offender here is the data grid control. I hate that thing with passion, with deep passion, because it's nearly impossible to style and produces a just horrible markup. Now, another benefit is, hypothetically, if you have, you know, a site, well, you define your content, and then you can have many skins. And there are two really silly features in ASP.NET, which I never quite understood, the skins and the themes. And I never understood why you wouldn't put representational attributes and scatter them throughout files, and then do some weird switching of, you know, skins and themes. I always prefer to focus on my markup, and then you can easily implement a style switcher, which will take, you know, this CSS file, that CSS file, apply on the fly. So I find that much more efficient.
Sorry, can I jump in real quick? Yeah, you know, I totally agree on that, and I've fought with themes and skins over the years. The only possible use that I've thought of that would come up, or two reasons I could think of why people might use themes. One is because it's more of a Visual Studio control first approach versus having to learn CSS. Right. And one other thing which is very different about the themes is that they're applied after the CSS, or, you know, so after any other kind of styling. It's a reverse kind of like the way CSS works is it's very, you know, like you define your style for the site, you define inline styles potentially in the page, and then you define styles, mm-hmm. you know, for an element, and it cascades down. So the most specific one wins, whereas with themes, theme always wins. I guess you might want to use that for like a corporate standard or something, but, you know, to force all text controls to have the certain color. But I don't like it at all. I'm trying to think of what even the point would be.
I tried it once or twice, and I was so frustrated with, you know, fighting that the switcheroo that I simply give up, and that just wasn't worth it. Mm-hmm. But again, that's just my opinion. I never found good application for that stuff. Now, another benefit I can think of is that the cleaner markup has a really smaller footprint. The pages load a little quicker. You don't waste bandwidth. And if you have your CSS in an external file and you have JavaScript in an external file, all that gets cached on the client, so you don't have to re-download it every time. In terms of bandwidth savings, I did an interesting exercise, and that was like back in 2004. I took apart Microsoft.com, the site that never ceases to amaze me just how badly it's developed. So back then, it worked only in whatever the current IE was. Like 2004, was it IE5 or something? It didn't work anywhere else, acceptably. So I took it apart, and I put it back together within, I think, only a couple of hours. And interestingly enough, so it's cleaned up the markup because it was very inefficient. So I cleaned it up a little bit, put it back together, and I made sure that it worked in Opera I think Navigator was still around. So whatever the current browsers were at the time. Gee, it's been only 5 years and I can't remember. And Microsoft had this interesting site, Microsoft Backstage, which disappeared at some point. But it was very interesting in the sense that they put out articles on how Microsoft.com was architected. They had statistics on the traffic. And they had, let me see, the original page size was about 50K, which, come to think of it, isn't huge, but rebuilt, it was 15.5. Also, it was served uncompressed. I see very little reason not to use compression these days, because just about every client understands gzip and deflate, and if they don't, then you don't compress. But most of them do, anyway, so compression, I think, should be used whenever possible. So if I compressed that page, the page that I redesigned, it came down to 5K, pretty much a little less. So I looked up at the traffic stats at Microsoft.com and crunched some numbers, and it came up to 6.6 terabytes of saved bandwidth per month. 6.6 terabytes just by reducing the page size and serving like a smaller, leaner page. That was pretty. I think that's a pretty impressive number, but I guess they didn't bother.
And that was without changing the look of the page at all, right? Like, you redesigned it in the HTML.
The look
and
was
CSS.
Completely the same.
Yeah.
It was the same, and actually, like, the side menu worked like it was supposed to because of pulling apart in other browsers. And that was a fun exercise. If anybody is interested, there's a five post series called Microsoft.com Redesign. You can look it up. And it documented everything, like every step, how I put it back together and applied the style sheets and then compression and all that. So that was a lot of fun. And to me, it was a little bit of an eye opener because, like, when you just say, well, you know, the pages are smaller, that's cool. But when you multiply it by like millions of visitors per month, then it really adds up fast. Another benefit to the approach of building web standards is accessibility. I guess we don't talk that much about accessibility, but for example, like governmental websites are supposed to comply with the famous Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, and we should really accommodate. So the idea is to accommodate people with various disabilities so they will be able to use the website. And that includes things such as understanding color blindness and what our visitors, how they perceive color. So on my website, if you go to the tools section, there's a color blindness simulator. And actually, I have source code, which you guys can download as just use of the component. And you can lift an image from like Bing.com and feed it, and you will see how this image is perceived by people with three types of different color blindness, which is quite revealing because you feed an image with a lot of colors and what comes out is a little different. And you're like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be using red and green on the same page, you know? So that's always an interesting exercise. So these are the benefits, and of course, it's not all perfect. There is a steep learning curve. I'm not saying this is simple. It isn't. There is a learning curve, and it's very frustrating. It's less frustrating these days, I find, because the browsers are much, much better than they were like 5 years ago. I don't really use any hacks, maybe an occasional box model hack, but that's about it. So I think it's a little easier in that sense. But still, we have older browsers floating around, such as i6, and as much as we hate it and we kick it, it's not going away. Anytime soon, as much as we hope it would, but it won't go away. So we have to accommodate for that and test in all the browsers. And normally what I find is I develop in Firefox, and even Safari 4 has gotten really good. You know, and then you look in A6 and you just start pulling your hair out because it's broken. So I'm not saying it's easy, but eventually it's really worth it. So that's what I've been doing it for all these years.
This might be a boring podcast because I think we pretty much all agree.
Well, we need some controversy.
Kevin, disagree on something.
We can get into more disagreeable topics here later, I think. But first, I wanted to ask what an ASP.NET developer should be doing to move in this direction. Should they be sticking with web forms or looking at MVC? Or if they are sticking with web forms, what should they be doing?
With web forms, you have to fight the server controls all the time. And I think usage of server controls shifts the focus a little bit incorrectly. It takes you away from the client-side development and into these abstractions, the user controls are very, very handy. I find it great to just reference a control and assign it to say .text and assign some string to it. It's great, but you really have to fight the framework. And I find that a lot of times it's counterproductive and you can't really do anything about it. So for example, the menu control has been notorious for doing the table. And so they came up with control adapters. So we have this weird situation where you have a menu control and then you define an adapter, you plug it in, then you hack the rendering, and then you produce cleaner markup. And I keep asking myself, why couldn't you write it clean in the first place, right? So that's my goal. If you develop server controls, focus on producing good, clean markup and pay attention. We talk about, you know, refactoring of code all the time, but I have an article on my website, refactoring the client side, and it's just as much doable. You look at your HTML and you find inefficiencies and you go back, you optimize. So you can take out, if you have tags that have certain common traits, then you can just like assign a common CSS class to them. Speaking of CSS classes, since ASP.NET tends to destroy IDs of controls, such as when you put a control inside of another naming container, such as a panel or a master page, you end up with this huge ID of blah_blah, and then eventually your control D comes. So the control D becomes unpredictable, and you can't really apply a CSS rule to it if you want to target a particular control. So what the class of developers do is they assign a class, which is not going to change, but that's really, really pushing the envelope. That's abusing the idea of using classes because they need to apply to, you know, a group of common elements. So that's definitely a struggle. So coming back to your question, Scott, I'm playing with MVC just a little bit now, and there are certain things I like about it. There's some things I really dislike. But what I do appreciate about it is that it resurrects client development because we don't have the regime of server controls anymore. So we're much closer to just the bare HTML. So in that sense, I think MVC will bring back a little bit of, will shift the focus back to where client development is supposed to happen, which is on the client side.
So Milan, if web standards and client development are so important, why do we have so many people building proprietary things like Silverlight and Flash? Is it possible to build a rich internet application using just web standards?
That's an excellent question, and I'm a Silverlight skeptic, really. Josh Holmes was doing a great talk at DevLink just recently, and the money quote was, you have to ask yourself if you're solving a business problem or you're solving your ego problem by playing with Silverlight because it's a brand new shiny toy. That was a great quote, considering that he's a Microsoft evangelist, so he's a proponent of all things Silverlight. I think there are good uses for Silverlight and Flash. They do suffer from poor usability. And really, when it comes to Silverlight, well, I'll answer that question later. But can you build something with web standards as opposed to Flash? I think a lot of ways you can. There are certain things where you actually do need rich media. You have to use Flash or Silverlight or something of that nature. So it's a tool, you know, as long as, you know, when you're holding a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if Silverlight is your new toy and like you want to make everything Silverlight, I think that's a very wrong approach. So when I see someone say, oh, I'll put like a login control, I'll make it in Silverlight. And I ask myself, like, why would you do this? And we've been training people on the web for like many, many years to use just the basic primitives, such as, you know, text control, a scroll bar. So how many more scroll bars do we need? It's frustrating to figure it out. You know, to us geeks, maybe it's easy, but to, you know, an average person, that's very difficult. So the big area that is not being talked about in all the discussion of Silverlight is really usability. And I think it's kind of sad, actually.
So there's three different kinds of Silverlight apps that I see normally. Like, some are, as you're kind of talking about, the full screen, take over the browser, don't bother with that yucky HTML and CSS stuff. Let's just build everything as a web, you know, as a WinForm, but in the browser. And then there's also the kind of like, you know, put what I think the marketing term is islands of richness, or I don't know what they're calling it now, but you know, where you kind of drop a little, like you build with CSS, HTML, and then you kind of drop a little thing in there to do whatever it is you need to do, you know, edit an image and do red eye reduction in the browser without client side in, or, you know, server upload or, you know, whatever, that kind of stuff. And then the third, I guess, is kind of like the maybe a justifiable kind of full screen or big application, which is like if you've got an application that's doing a lot of media, because sometimes there are some websites out there that use media, like, you know, YouTube or something. I don't know. Do you think right, any of those right. are justifiable, or what's the, are you mostly upset at the first one, the take over the browser, because you don't want to bother with HTML, or, you know, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I've attended a whole bunch of user group meetings and code camp presentations on Silverlight. And the first thing, what is the first thing they demo in a Silverlight app or in a Silverlight talk? Any takers?
Video.
At media player, bingo. They do like 30 seconds of the Fantastic Four or something, right? And then what happens next?
Bouncy ball or spinny cube.
Yes.
That too. But then when I see the presenter, basically every time I see the presenter struggle with drawing a circle and then maybe a rectangle and then say, well, look, I can move it from here over here, you know, all the way apologizing that he or she doesn't have artistic skills. So that to me seems like such a big disconnect. It's like you have this dazzling video and then like you struggle to create anything simple and primitive in it. And I don't know, maybe just the wrong people are giving presentations and not representing the technology correctly. So that's my sort of one beef with it. The whole promise of not writing JavaScript, I think you, John, mentioned it, that bothers me in such a big way, because they keep making these lame promises that we'll give you this, we'll give you that, you don't have to write JavaScript. And what I always do whenever I give a talk, I say JavaScript is a fine language. It's a tool for a very specific purpose. So instead of running away from it, embrace it. It's not that difficult to learn, and it's fun to an extent. So instead of fighting it, embrace it, because you're gonna write JavaScript no matter what if you're a web developer. So I think that whole promise of, oh, we'll give you Silverlight, you don't have to write JavaScript, is a little bit on the shallow side. Another problem I have with Silverlight really is just the poor marketing. I think they come with the wrong message delivered to the wrong audience. Like the example I gave you of a presenter struggling with like two shapes of changing color and then maybe like squishing each other, whatever. I think they should be going after the media professionals. So for example, I work with some very, very talented Flash developers. They can do some wicked stuff, but they're really laughing at Silverlight right now because they can't do even a fraction of that with Silverlight. So I think hurting us into user group meetings and like pitching Silverlight, and like we just sit there and salivate and like, all right, well, how am I going to use this? You know, that seems to me just so wrong. Well, they need to be going after a different crowd with a different message. And then I guess finally, you know, we the ASP.NET developers, I think a lot of us come from the backend background. I see very few people having a mighty change of heart and who say like, oh, I don't like Python, I'll switch to ASP.NET, or I don't like Ruby, I'll switch to ASP.NET. It doesn't happen that much. So we backend developers aren't exactly educated on the principles of design, which is why I think the usability of what we build oftentimes suffers really bad. So I think there is an educational gap here where we need to educate developers at least on the basics of design. Again, I'm not trying to scare you with graphic design, because when I say design, people usually think, oh, graphic design, I'm not good with Photoshop. That's not what it is. Design is about solving problems, and we do that every day. So we're designers in a sense. If you don't have Photoshop skills, you don't have graphic skills. That's fine. We have professionals for that. But we really need to be aware of the usability of whatever we produce. And I think especially in the Serverlite camp, that's really, really lacking right now. That's my other, you know, contention with Serverlite.
Should I argue? Because somebody... I don't know. I think, you know, I agree with you to a very large extent. Like, I'm a big fan of, you know, the semantic markup. And I think if you do that, then JavaScript, especially jQuery, just works so smoothly with that. I really do get upset when I use a website that takes a minute to load up a Silverlight app that's basically a bunch of text and hyperlink buttons and all this stuff and, you know, maybe a couple of images. And, you know, when you get right down to it, there's one video player. I ran across one of those a few months ago, and it's just really frustrating. You know, and I said, hey, I'll copy some text. Oops, can't do that. You know, I'll right-click on this hyperlink and copy the, you know, the URL. Oops, I get a about Silverlight, you know. So I definitely think that it's overdone and it's done in the wrong places. But I think the two things that Silverlight brings you that you, the big place for Silverlight and for Flash, like number one is if you've got to actually write a serious application that's doing anything major, it can get really tricky to build a full application in the browser. You know what I mean? And maybe that's the best uses in, yes, in JavaScript, but you can get to places where, for instance, like threading, browsers just don't have the threading that Silverlight does. Or, you know, if you've got to take advantage of advanced things like pixel shaders or, you know, advanced graphics, I think you're just way beyond what most browsers will support, even with, you know, limited canvas support and that kind of thing.
That's very true. Very true.
Okay. Okay. And then the one other thing that I think is an argument for Silverlight, Flash, rich internet app, JavaFX, I guess I have to throw that in, is that they can potentially like roll out a lot faster than browsers. You know, so browser, we're still, like you were saying earlier, we're still fighting IE6, and the thing just won't die. You know, and you know, there's a lot of people on IE7. IE8's been out for a long time. Well, as I see it, and you know, it's like what, a 30% ish, you know, adoption. It's like those things take a long time to creep up, and asking someone to upgrade their browser is a big deal, or switch browsers. Whereas if you say, hey, install this plugin and you can get this feature that was released 2 months ago. So I think that, you know, like for, if you want to work with cutting edge technologies, it's nice to be able to work with, like Silverlight 2 came out in October of 2008 and Silverlight 3 came out just this summer. And so it's like boom, 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 you know, rapid release compared to the browser release cycle.
Right.
So one of the other arguments that I see against Silverlight is kind of more of an implied argument, in that you've been able to build these kind of line of business apps for the last 10 years using Flash, and it's gotten easier, you know, with the release of the Flex framework and as Flash has kind of marched on, but people just haven't been doing it because there's not enough value in it necessarily. So even if you do build this great whiz-bang LOB app in Flash, you still got to get the people to install the plugin. They still have to update, maintain the plugin, and the IT people just aren't willing to do that unless they get it forced on them by, you know, some VP or exec. That's been my general impression. I've tried three different times to sell Silverlight or Flash as a replacement for writing a really complicated UI in JavaScript, and I haven't been able to do it simply because they've tried to, you know, they just don't want to take the plugin hit. They don't want to take the plugin hit. If you're going to take the plugin hit, why not just write a complete, you know, WPF app or a one-click install or a Java applet or something like that?
Actually, at DevLink, Josh, again, go back to Josh Holmes, said that he asks his clients, does something, a particular app, does it have to be Silverlight? Maybe, and then somebody in the audience said, oh, click once. And he's like, yeah, because click once, you know, it's easy to deploy, and then you don't have to make that installation maintenance, you know, nightmare. So maybe so. Again, it really depends.
Well, I was going to say that John was just mentioning about browsers moving very slow. At the same time, we went from Silverlight 1.1 to Silverlight 2 to Silverlight 3. It's all been a very rapid succession. And that's just one product team at Microsoft. There's what, 90,000 employees there now. It seems like they're all writing new frameworks every 6 months. Does it seem that crazy to you too?
You mean the avalanche of all the new stuff?
Yeah, just new stuff every 2 weeks or so.
That is crazy. I was actually talking to a friend of mine at a user group, and he said, I just pulled the last arrow out of my butt, and Microsoft is hitting me with more because they just these things keep coming, you know, keep coming and coming. And I think it was, if you really try to learn everything, you'll go completely insane because the .NET framework is huge. There's absolutely no way you can know all of it. So don't even try. So decide, I guess it takes a little bit of retrospection to see what it is that you really enjoy doing. And do you want to be a generalist or a specialist? So for example, I specialize in web development. That's what I focus on. There are certain basics that never change. I find a lot of developers, I was doing a phone screen with a person just recently, and I was asking questions in terms of, I was trying to push him a little bit in terms of abstraction, but he kept telling me, oh, the Visual Studio does that, or ASP.NET does that. And he was doing something like for 7 years, but he really didn't know why he was doing it, which is, I think is kind of tragic. So it really pays to learn the basics, and the basics don't really change that much, despite all the everything comes out like every couple of weeks. You also have to pay attention to who's talking in a very literal sense. So for example, Microsoft evangelist. I know it's a little bit of a touchy subject to some people, especially the Microsoft evangelist. There are some really good ones, like Josh and Joe Stagner, and I guess I'm committing a sin of omission here by not mentioning others. But there are also those who are very, very salesy. There are salespeople, they're Microsoft employees. Their job is to sell you an idea of using a particular technology. So it's up to you whether you want to accept it or not. It's like somebody knocks on your door, tries to sell you something, you say no, thank you. You can do the same thing. So you just really need to understand that their priorities sometimes are very different from ours. Case in point, we had these MSDN events. Does anybody, by the way, go to MSDN events anymore? Do you guys have any in your area?
It's been a while.
Our area has, yeah, I can't think of the last MSDN event. They seem to have road shows lately.
Oh, and, yes, they rebranded them.
Yeah, and maybe that's the same thing, but rebranded.
I hardly ever have anything up in Seattle. I mean, there's code camps and occasional nerd dinners, but I don't know. Maybe I don't get out enough.
Well, I used to go to a lot of those. We had those in New York City here all the time. And eventually, I simply got sick of them and gave up because it was a pitch after pitch after pitch every single time they were trying to sell something. And it wasn't about education at all. It was obvious that they were just trying to hook everyone up on all these new shiny toys. And I talked to one of the guys who ran it afterwards a couple of years later, and he apologetically admitted that, yes, that was expected of them. They were basically pushed to be salesy in this way. But then again, I don't want to make a general or really generic statement by saying all of Microsoft evangelists are like that. But that's their job. You need to understand that. That's their job, to sell to you the idea of using Servlet, for example, or Oslo, even though it's so far on the horizon that I can't really justify to my clients, for example, because I've become a very practical, pragmatic person over the years. So I try to, these days, I pretty much ignore all the betas because I feel that I'm wasting my clients' money and time if I sit there and they tinker with beta 1, beta 2, and they keep paying for me rewriting that stuff. It helps to understand where the general direction where things are going, but I just don't waste my time with all that as much anymore. So the next source of noise, I guess, are conferences. I never go to the big conferences, the PDCs and the TechEds, because I think they create some kind of a weird peer pressure on people. Besides the fact that they're just booze and noise, and they're very expensive to attend to begin with. They are really a showcase for a lot of the new stuff, and I find there's very, I just look at the agendas, and I find there's very little pragmatic stuff. So some people, who especially those who are active in the community, they tend to educate developers on what's being, in practical terms, of the stuff that we use now and how to use it correctly. You see the exact same folks talk at code camps, and I welcome that. But then there are, of course, the familiar A-listers who are cheerleaders, and they create a lot of noise. So that frustrates a lot of people, I feel. So again, you have to understand, you have to see who's talking, what their job is, what their priorities are.
So I think Ted Neward had this, or I don't know if he was the originator of the quote, but he said that that junior developers go to conferences for the sessions and senior developers go for the people. See, there's a lot more value in the hallway conversations and the networking and the blackmail photos of people getting drunk at VIP parties afterwards than there is in sitting there and getting marketed to for 6 hours a day.
That's why I was saying it's booze and noise. Now, Somebody talked to DevCamp, and I'm not going to disclose the name, said that he was planning to go down to the next mix and just not even go to the conference, but like rent a hotel room and go to the conference to hang out with people and do the hallway conversations, like you said. So there's definitely something there. Oh, and speaking of mix, I don't know if you guys saw it on Twitter, but I think it's like the Axe shampoo of conferences. And I'm really referring to the Juvenile brand of the Axe shampoos and the body sprays and all that stuff. And I think they were onto something with mix. The first year they did the right thing, and it looked like South by Southwest, which is what it was, a knockoff of South by Southwest. The first year I think it was fine, but then went right back to being a very Microsoft conference, all about the shiny, the new shiny stuff. So, which is kind of a shame. So I'm voting for South by Southwest next year.
I kind of got that impression of mix also. Initially, it was I don't know if it's necessarily a takeoff of South by Southwest. The idea being that they'd invite all of these PHP devs and pure like graphic designers and usability experience people to mix with the propeller heads and gear heads that are .NET devs, and then invite Java devs just so they kind of get a cross pollination of ideas. And the last couple of times it's just turned into the Silverlight showcase showdown kind of.
It totally did. Yep.
And they've got their script, and that's how they do it. So they have keynotes, and then they have the funny video where whoever's doing the keynote does wacky things with funny clothing, and then they have someone who's supposed to be respected but we've never heard of get up and give a keynote, and then they have special gifts to give out in the bags, and sneak previews of things that only you, the elite, get to see because you're at the conference until we post the video on the web 10 minutes later.
Well, that's maybe a little bit negative. I mean, okay, so I agree that there's a lot of silver light there, but they also announce a lot of stuff about web in general, including like IE, which, love it or hate it, that's where you usually hear the newer things about Internet Explorer. And then the people that they have speak are usually along the lines of user experience folks, or I agree. I think I did get more of a feeling at the first Mix 06 that there was a little more like, open web stuff and interoperability and stuff like that. But the people that do speak that I find, most interesting are a lot of time, like Bill Buxton is very interesting ideas on user experience. I don't know, a little bit of counterpoint, maybe.
Well, here's my suggestion to the listeners. Don't go to the big conferences, the wholesale conferences. Go participate in a local community, because I like those a lot more. Again, going back to DevLink, that was more of a code camp, really, with a little bit of a registration fee, which really actually creates commitment. So I think that was an interesting take on the paid code camp. And it was great. And I do think that the best things happen in the community. That's where you find the best people. And I do encourage folks to go out there and reach out to the user groups and then those who run code camps in the area, and just suggest to the topics, and volunteer to present, volunteer to help. And I think this is really where you can find the best employees in that sense. I really have a sense that HR departments around the country are just wasting their time by fishing at like Monster or Dice, where they should be plugged into the community and, getting out there, shaking hands, but not as recruiters, but as if they really care, meeting people and just trying to get a sense of the community itself. I think it's much more valuable than harvesting resumes. So, but that's, again, that's, I'm very pro-community, so that's my humble opinion in a sense.
So, yeah, I generally agree. One other nice thing with that is if you're going to your local community to get plugged in, you're around people that you can say, hey, let's meet for lunch in a month or something like that. And so you have a local community, which is nice. And then the big conferences lately post basically everything either live at the conference or very soon. The keynotes are live or most sessions are streamed very soon afterwards. So if one were to follow your advice, I don't think you'd really necessarily miss out on any actual information. There's nothing you couldn't get by not going to the conference.
No booze and no noise.
That's true.
I've got kids and a fifth at home.
So you just turned into an independent consultant here recently. With the recession in the state that it's been in for the last year and a half or so, was that a good idea? Are things working out for you?
Well, I was a business owner or business co-owner for about 5 years, and then I was a not-so-independent consultant for some time, and I decided to eventually put my practice to good use and go the full independent route. It does sound, I guess, some people a little crazy with the times and everything, but I had an interesting conversation with a coworker just recently, and she said, do you really want to give up all the security full-time? Why don't you come here and work here full-time? Because, you know, going consulting, you know, in this economy, I don't know, it's a little scary. Why not just have the security? And all I could do really was laugh, because I said, your job is secure? They can dismiss you anytime they want. They will come and tap in the shoulder and say, do you have 10 minutes for a quick conversation, like maybe on Friday morning, on Monday morning? And that's it. They will walk you out the door, and that's where it ends. So much for the security. When you're a consultant, you know the score. You know if you have money, if you don't have money, but you know the score, and you don't really blame anyone. I think when you work for someone full time, try asking for, by the way, for a balance sheet, take a look, or for some financial reports. See what they tell you. You never know when the axe falls. So I just want to kind of convey this thought that this whole job security thing is a myth. There is no such thing. And as soon as you understand that there is no such thing as job security, I think you will function much, much better. And you can do something about it. For example, I always prefer to, when I was, worked full time, to think of myself as a one-person brand. Try to be very valuable to your employer and try to develop your own personal brand. Your name is your very best brand. So again, get out there, maybe run a blog, participate in the community, and just stand out from the crowd. That's really the best way to do it. As you know, as David Ogilvy said, make yourself indispensable to the client and they will never fire you. And that's, I pretty much live by that quote. So there's definitely a lot of things you can do. One thing is to not get over scared. I don't like seeing when somebody gets intimidated, with the whole talk of, keep your mouth shut and keep your head down because the economy sucks. You'll be out in the streets like everybody else. That's not cool. And that's going to come back to people who do that to others. Because the economy, again, maybe it's a little bit of political talk, but I think the economy functions just fine. It's going through a natural purge process. It's purging the inefficiencies and the wasteful processes. So it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. It was coming and finally it's happening. So in a sense, I'm happy to see it because we've been sort of in this stagnation for a while, but it is happening. It's painful. I don't like seeing people unemployed and out of jobs, but it just needs to happen. So I don't get too depressed about news of some latest statistics of unemployment numbers and such, because like I said, the economy functions as designed. So don't let yourself be intimidated by, these threats that you really should be obedient and, shut up and work quietly. Yeah, there is really no right or wrong here, full-time or independent consultant, but I think there is this fear-mongering that because it sucks out there, full-time is so much better, where it really isn't. I think in a lot of ways it's worse because you just never know when it's coming. And they intimidate you too. And I find as a consultant it's a little easier for me because if I want to end a relationship, I can, and I walk away with my own health insurance, with my own pension plan, with my own 529 for my daughter, and I get to keep it. Whereas, whether you will be given a severance package or not, that's a big unknown. So it may be crazy. We'll see how it works out, but at least I'm determined to make it. And interesting enough, again, whether you believe statistics or not, but more companies, more small businesses start during downtime than during the prosperous times. And considering that, America is driven by small businesses, that's kind of a positive thing. You see a lot of people go out there and they maybe get sick of the corporate life and they start something of their own, or they're forced to. Again, it's painful, but it's necessary.
Well, there's a flip side to that, which is in tough times, some companies are more apt to use consultants rather than hire full-time employees, in part for accounting reasons. They're lower overhead entity on their books. I'm curious if do you see that? Do you see that, as a consultant, in some ways it's a little easier out there?
I don't see it easier, but I do see a lot of really cute hiring freeze schemes, which is a cost reduction technique. I don't think most of those companies will be hiring back when things get a little better. I think they will learn to live with the resources they have, like it's supposed to be. I think they will reevaluate maybe some of the wasteful practices. So I don't really see it much, but I almost feel it, because I think hiring a consultant is a pretty painless, well, it goes both ways. But from the standpoint of accounting, it's pretty painless because you don't have to provide, you don't have to pay benefits, you don't have to worry about taxes. The consultant takes care of everything on his or her own. But definitely, I think the whole hiring freeze, all those different schemes opened up some opportunities for us, because they're apprehensive, companies are apprehensive of hiring full-timers because it's a commitment to bring on a person full-time. Yet at the same time, they have to, solve their business problems, or otherwise they will simply go belly up. So in a way, I feel that some of them are simply cornered and they decided to kind of go with their own indecisiveness of, we don't want to hire full-time people, but we really need to get this done. And not even in a bad way. I mean, that's natural.
We did have one more topic. I think the first time we met in person was an MVP summit in 2005, or it was a few years ago. But and you were an MVP for a while, but you're not anymore. What you indicated that you had some thoughts about the MVP program these days. What are those thoughts?
I was an MVP for about 4 years, and when I came, it was interesting, and you really had to work hard. At least I thought I thought so, to get into the MVP program, because it operates with the Hollywood mentality. You know, don't call us, we'll call you. So you get invited, you get nominated. I think the bar was much higher back then. I think that it got very big. It got very impersonal, and they kept shuffling MVP leads, and it just felt like it was yet another corporate initiative out of Microsoft, just by reading emails. And the whole communication was, it pretty much became one way, sort of a MVP lead to, you know, broadcasting, again, marketing messages, pretty much, to the MVPs. And I looked at all my emails, and it was like they were flooding me with spam, pretty much. And I thought, well, where's the value of the MVP program? And I talked to one of the guys who was one of the first MVP leads, and I shared this and thought, maybe I'm crazy, maybe I'm overreacting. But ironically, he said the exact same thing. After the first wave of MVP leads left, the program simply was never the same. It became, like I said, just a marketing channel, a yet another marketing channel to push all the latest and, you know, quote unquote greatest stuff down to to the masses. And last I attended the MVP summit, they were bragging how huge the attendance was, and I was sort of wandering around, and it felt like a mega conference. Like you couldn't talk to anyone, like nobody knew anybody else. It lost its personal feel. Which is why I eventually gave up, and we had a kind of a funny exchange. They emailed me and said, hey, we nominated you for, like, that was last year. And I said, well, I don't really want to be in the program anymore. And my then MVP lead, whose name I cannot remember because they kept changing them every couple of months, said, oh, no, I evaluated you, and you're good. And I said, well, no, I did say I did not want to be in the program anymore. So she said, oh, sure, we would like to hear some feedback. I guess her boss jumped in on the conversation. It's like, oh, yeah, we would like to get some feedback and, you know, see your concerns and everything. And I said, all right, I'll be happy to discuss it with you guys and then, you know, tell you things. And that never happened. So I don't know if they're not interested eventually or whatever, but it just never happened.
Unfortunate.
And I know that some people stay in the program just for the subscription, which it's a personal issue. I just encourage those who are still in the MVP program to sort of do a little bit of a, you know, retrospection and think, is it really worth it? Am I contributing? Is the program doing anything? I do have one good friend who says, I want to change things from the inside, which is why I'm staying in the program. That I appreciate in a big way. That is great, great attitude. But other than that, if it's just the MSDN subscription, guys, think about it. No need to encourage the MVP program, at least in the shape that it is.
See, I thought it was interesting. I was an MVP for an entire year, I guess. And I went to the summit, luckily, and I went to PDC as an MVP. And so I was kind of engaged in the culture. Some of the things that disturbed me about it were that I had no idea why I got nominated. I had no idea how I could maintain my status. There wasn't like a list of things I could do. There wasn't any way to, you know, it was all very subjective. And, you know, it's their program. They can do whatever. That's the way I kind of approached it. You know, it was something that I didn't strive for. So to me, it didn't have that much value. It's like if somebody just comes up and gives you something, you don't really, you know, a lot of times you don't really keep track of it. You don't really care about it as much as if you went out and worked hard to get something or bought it with your own money kind of thing. I don't know. Maybe I know that there are some MVPs out there that work really, really hard. Like Steve Andrews drives all over the U.S. to talk at user groups in out of the way places. Alan Stevens and Keith Elder are both always flying places to talk and give talks and donating their time to the community. And those kinds of people, I think, should be celebrated. And I think there are some people there that are just kind of perma MVPs because they work for a vendor or, you know, they're in the good old boys network, they're ex-softies, they're whatever. And, you know, it's just like any other program. There's good people in it, there's bad people in it. I thought the summit was interesting because it was mostly the same people that I had seen at PDC. Just in kind of a different setting. I didn't actually get to participate in much of the summit just because I had just gotten laid off the Friday prior and I was in the middle of a bunch of interviews and job hunting that week.
Friday is just not cool. Monday is better.
I know.
Friday is neat.
Well, it actually worked out really well because this was a really shitty company and we just delivered a really shitty product and and they were concerned that, you know, they'd canceled all vacation and personal time off, and they were not encouraging to take sick days if you were sick because they wanted to have everyone on deck in case the project just completely died on launch. so I wasn't going to get to go to the summit. So I was really glad that they laid me off because I got to go network at a time when I really needed to network, which sounds a little, you know, Machiavellian, but hey, it worked. And so one of the other things that I thought was interesting about it was that you got to interact with the product groups, but not really. In that you were, you know, they would say, what do you think about this? And we'd say, well, we think it should change. And they would say, well, it's too late to change. Maybe in the next version. So, you know, you kind of felt like, so what are we doing here? Are we just hanging out and you're demoing some stuff to me that, you know, I didn't see a lot of value in it. And the fact that everything was under NDA was kind of useless because, you know, either Mary Jo Foley has already blogged about it or, you know, you can't go. One of the things that I thought I could bring a value to the MVP program was filtering community feedback to the product teams. I thought, well, you know, they can't interact with everybody. So maybe if I try to interact with a lot of people and get their feedback on stuff, then I can just pass it on to them and act like a filter. But I couldn't tell everybody about the stuff I was seeing, so I couldn't gather feedback on it. And that's where I think the MVC product differs from basically everything else at Microsoft. MVC and Managed Extensibility have both been very open and transparent about the way that they've developed the product and have been very good about incorporating feedback. So if they get to that level of transparency, they almost don't need an MVP program except as kind of a reward or a kickback to people who have promoted Microsoft stuff.
You mentioned the interaction with product groups. I think that's a great point. I wish we had more of it. The MVP Summit kind of helps. And I would love to have more opportunities to interact with a product group, but maybe other product groups are different, but I found that the ASP.NET team is pretty stubborn about things.
I think that does make a big difference, the different product teams. I mean, I'm not a Silverlight MVP, but my interaction with the Silverlight team early on was different than that. Like, they were very interested in what we thought about things, very eager to make changes, and it was a little scary almost. I was afraid to give feedback because I knew a lot of the time they'd do what I said, and I wanted to, you know what I mean? I was scared to tell them to do something and have them do it, and it was a waste of their time. So, but I do think that really depends on the product group quite a bit.
I agree.
Yeah, and it also depends kind of how far down the stack your product group is. So stuff like ASP.NET and Silverlight, I think they have a little more leeway than, like, I was in the Visual C#, I guess, group. So, you know, when I'm going suggesting things, it's changes to the language that everything else is built with. So they're kind of leery about just incorporating any whack idea I had into their, you know, language or the framework itself.
Yeah. So what did you want to say about alt.net?
Well, I guess it's quite a polarizing subject, or, you know, I guess to some people. But even though I'm not a card-carrying member of, you know, the alt.net mafia, and I can't whip out an hibernate mapping file in my sleep, but I do appreciate what's being done by that community. I think we were fed sort of a one-sided story by Microsoft for all these years that alt.net is a very needed counterbalance to the kind of practice that Microsoft puts out, prescriptive guidance Microsoft puts out. For example, the PMP curve, I don't know what's wrong with them, but the guidance they put out is such remarkable crap. I downloaded the architectural guide version 2.0, and I went through, it's like 358 pages of nothing. And then you look at the various articles that they publish here and there, and like, they can't get the singleton correctly, and they do like other stupid stuff. So if somebody wants to really understand architect and application, I don't think they have much chance if they simply follow the Microsoft PMP guidance. So I'm not sure what's going on there, but what they do really upsets me. So I think L.NET brought a little bit of a fresh perspective into this. And at least we're not talking about the rad mentality so much. And I think we're finally asking the right questions. It's important. I feel that whatever comes out of L.NET sort of puts us in the right frame of mind. So, for example, I think we finally understand that developing a piece of software is neither quick nor easy. I don't know why we can't openly admit it, because, you know, it's developed by people for other people, and everything people related is inherently messy. So it's not a simple process, and it's not a cheap process. But at the same time, the whole Microsoft, you know, Kool-Aid machine gives us this rad tools, and there's so much emphasis. Oh, we'll give you a wizard. We'll give you this drag and drop. So in that sense, I think alt.net is doing a, you know, good service to all of us.
So it's interesting that you brought up PNP, because you and I and several others had a discussion today about their singleton implementation it's the second result in Google. If you Google for Singleton C#, the second link that comes up in the search results is the
John
one where
Keith must be number one, right?
No, it's Yoda something.
Yeah, well, that's him.
That's him. Okay, mm-hmm. It's John Skeet's page. Thank God. But that second one is still up there, and I don't know if they've updated the guidance somewhere else, but it's from like 2 or 3 or 4
years
ago. Yeah,
they do have a page with the correct implementation somewhere, like in my blog post that I put on Twitter. There's a link there. So it's like they're not talking to each other almost. And Nflip, I know it's not exactly a PNP, but you were talking about Nflip on Twitter today again.
Oh, God, Hebrarcy.
Oh, yes. Amen. Yeah. Every single blog from Nflip that I used, I had to rip out and throw away. I did give it a chance. I used the logging block, the caching block, data access block, and oh, God, the cab. That was something. Every single thing that I touched, I had to eventually throw it away because it just didn't work. So if you're using Nflip out there, reevaluate, because I just don't see how that could work correctly.
Yeah, in this case today, we just hadn't registered the event source correctly, or we didn't configure the event source in the Nflip logging block in our web config, and it just failed silently. It didn't throw an exception, it didn't write anything in there. So there was no way to really, debug it. You just had to keep Googling and asking on Twitter until someone said, yeah, that happened to me, and find it. And, if that was really disappointing that, there wasn't already an easily searchable answer for something that's so simple. But yeah, we'd like to reevaluate it, but I'm off the contract as of August 28th. And
whenever I hear this promise of simple, like, oh, we'll give Nflip all these blogs that just integrate seamlessly, which the phrase that scares me to death is integrate seamlessly, that just works.
Yes.
That just so much water.
Alrighty. Are we close to doing a wrap up for the show?
Seems like it.
Yeah. So, Milan, thanks for staying up late with us. Is there anything exciting coming up? Anything you want to plug or tell people to look at?
Well,
doing
in
any
the North
speaking?
Yes, in Northeast, we'll have a couple of conferences. In October and November, there's the Boston Code Camp, New England Code Camp. There's a Connecticut Code Camp coming up. I'm flying to the Utah Code Camp on September 19th. I don't know if anyone needs me in the area, but I have some good friends there, and there's a good community there, so I'm looking forward to that. And that we'll see. So there's a lot of code camps coming up, but there's very little activity in the summer. But all of a sudden, you look at September, October, and November, there's like one after another. And if I can make it to the Virginia, the Richmond code camp, I'll do that. It's a little far from the People's Republic of New York, so we'll see.
All right, excellent. So thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Tune in again next week for the next episode of Herding Code.